Good afternoon, and may it please the court. My name is Adam Mueller, and I represent Mr. Harrell. My attorney registration number is 42176. As this court knows, the Supreme Court currently has before it two cases concerning the validity of conditional guilty pleas under Colorado law, Newhouse and Hoffman. And the briefing in those cases is complete, and all that remains is for the court to hear argument and rule. The case before you today also involves a conditional guilty plea, and I'm aware that at least two members of this division are of the view that such pleas are not presently authorized under Colorado law.
Excuse me, counsel.
Yes.
Ask you a question. Said that this case does involve a conditional guilty plea.
Yes, Judge.
Why?
How
does this plea constitute a conditional guilty plea?
Yes. At the plea hearing, Mr. Harrell's defense counsel stated on the record to the court and to the district attorney that he was pleading guilty on the understanding that he was still going to appeal the court's denial of the motion to suppress. There was a long discussion between the parties about the state of the law concerning conditional pleas at that time, and the parties acknowledged that there was a split, it appeared, in the Court of Appeals at that time. The district attorney's position was that the conditional plea split, I should say, if you want to call it that, would eventually be resolved in favor, or I guess against the validity of conditional pleas, whereas our position was that the Supreme Court would ultimately sanction conditional guilty pleas. The court made a record with defense counsel and with the defendant that the state of the law was uncertain and that he was free. The court's words were, you're free to ask the Court of Appeals to accept your appeal. They may or may not, but you need to understand that, but you're not forfeiting your right to ask for the appeal. The court may accept jurisdiction or it may not. And on appeal, I should say the state does not dispute that this was a conditional guilty plea. The state, of course, takes the position that such pleas are not valid, but the state never disputes that this was, in fact, a conditional guilty plea. And that's why I think this case was a conditional guilty plea.
Quite that simple. The prosecutor said not merely that it was their view that conditional plea shouldn't be allowed, but the prosecutor said he was not agreeing to a conditional plea. That was their position. He was not agreeing to allowed appeal. And plea agreements require agreement. And the conditional plea cases at least involve an agreement between the prosecutor and the defense counsel and the defendant that there is a conditional plea, and we don't have such an agreement here. So how is it a conditional plea?
Well, I think we do have such an agreement here, Your Honor, and otherwise I don't think the trial court would have accepted the plea. Otherwise, if there was a disagreement between the parties, then, as you said, there wasn't an agreement, and the trial court can't accept a plea of guilty when there isn't pursuant to an agreement if there isn't an agreement. And so the trial court made a clear record, and I accept that the trial court said, you know, you're pleading guilty, Mr. Harrell, on the understanding that the state of the law is, as yet, you know, unresolved. It's uncertain. And you may not have a division in the Court of Appeals that's willing to accept your plea. But the trial court, I don't think, would have been empowered to accept the plea agreement if there wasn't an agreement. And I don't think the Attorney General has argued otherwise here on appeal.
The prosecution here in this case said, as Judge Jones just said, I don't agree with this being a conditional plea, and he also said, he or she, I don't remember now, but also said that I want the defendant to understand that he will be waiving all of his appellate rights as far as I'm concerned. Prosecutor said that, not
yeah.
The court.
Yes, Judge, I think that was the prosecutor's position. As I understood the prosecutor's position below, it was that this plea would not come back, that the Court of Appeals would not accept it, but he was not forfeiting his right to ask for the appeal. And that's the crucial distinction here, because the trial court did not say what the prosecutor said. The trial court was clear that my client was not forfeiting his right to ask for the appeal. He was, I think, absolutely clear about that. And I think the dispute between the parties was concerning the validity of conditional guilty pleas at that time, and there still remains split, as I've said, which the Supreme Court is poised to resolve here in the near future, and which is why I would ask this court at the outset to hold Mr. Harrell's case pending the Supreme Court's resolution of that question in Newhouse and Hoffman. And I've spoken with the Assistant Attorney General, and although she obviously takes a different view than I do regarding the validity of conditional guilty pleas, she doesn't object to that procedure. So that's my request to the court at the outset, to hold the case pending the Supreme Court's resolution of the conditional plea issue in Newhouse and Hoffman.
May I interrupt you? Just,
I was going to ask, do you know when argument is scheduled?
My understanding, Your Honor, is they have not scheduled argument just yet. I know the briefing is complete. I spoke with, in Newhouse and Hoffman, the briefing is complete. I spoke with the attorneys who represent the defendants in those cases in my office, and the briefing is fully done. The reply briefs have been filed. But my understanding, at least as of yesterday, was the court had not set argument. But I would still ask, in any event, that this court hold the case until the Supreme Court rules in Newhouse and Hoffman.
Let me ask you, go further with the what I was asking before. How did the circumstances here in Mr. Harrell's case differ from those of Mr. McMurtry in the McMurtry case?
I'm sorry, I'm not familiar with the McMurtry case. I apologize. Are you talking about the conditional plea aspect of it, or are you talking about the motion to suppress? I apologize. I'm familiar with Newhouse and Hoffman and Bockhofer, but I did not review McMurtry before today. So I apologize for that. So for that reason, as I said, I'd ask this court to hold the case until Newhouse and Hoffman are decided, and I'd like to spend the rest of my time before you talking about the trial court's order on the motion to suppress. At the motions hearing before the trial court, the state did not argue that reasonable suspicion existed to justify the stop of Mr. Harrell. The state's only argument was that it was a consensual encounter. The trial court accepted that argument, and here we are. So the question before the court today on the merits is whether Mr. Harrell was seized within the meaning of the Fourth Amendment and Article 2, Section 7 of the Colorado Constitution, and I think the answer to that question is yes. The test to determine if the seizure occurred is a familiar one. If, in the view of all the circumstances, a reasonable person would not have felt free to terminate the encounter and leave, he was seized. Whereas if the officers merely solicited the voluntary cooperation of the suspect through non-coercive questioning, it was a consensual encounter. Where the officers don't use physical force to restrain the suspect, as here, the real question is whether the officer displayed his authority in a manner that would cause the defendant to submit. And this court is familiar with the facts, and so I won't go through a whole summary of them, but I did want to emphasize at least three of them, which I think show the officer in this case did display his authority in a manner that caused Mr. Harrell to submit. The first fact is that by his own admission, Officer Davis said, both at the preliminary hearing in this case and at the motions hearing, that the officers stopped Mr. Harrell and Mr. Purdy as they walked across the parking lot. Now, even if even if Officer Davis wasn't using the term stop in its legal sense, he was at the very least describing the conduct in that case and the actions of the police officers and the effect those actions had on Mr. Harrell. And the effect was to stop Mr. Harrell and Mr. Purdy. And that's on page 18 of the court file and page 13 of the suppression hearing transcript. And I'll just quote briefly from Officer Davis's testimony. He said my client and Mr. Purdy were coming out of the building and they were walking down the south side and they were stopped at that point in the west parking lot. Importantly, Officer Davis did not say, "We asked Mr. Harrell to stop." Officer Davis testified, "They were stopped." Second,
are we sure, Mr. Mueller, that when they say they were stopped, it means that the actor, it's passive voice.
It's passive voice.
So we don't know who did the stopping. Is it equally inferable that the defendant and his companion stopped themselves?
I don't think it is, Your Honor. I think Officer Davis's testimony, both when you combine the preliminary hearing testimony with his statement at the suppression hearing where he said, "I contacted them," and then the defense counsel confronted him with his statement from the preliminary hearing, and he said, "Yes, I stopped them." He put it in the first person at the suppression hearing, although he then chose the word contact as opposed to stop. But the preliminary hearing, he used the passive voice. I acknowledge that. The second fact I wanted to focus on is that Mr. Harrell and Mr. Purdy were separately questioned by these officers. Officer Davis questioned Mr. Harrell, and the other two officers questioned Mr. Purdy. That's on page 8 of the suppression hearing transcript, and the court acknowledged this in its ruling. On page 23, the court said Officer Davis was alone with Mr. Harrell when he questioned him. So there was a physical separation. We don't know how much distance, I'll concede that, between the two parties, but there was a physical separation. The third fact was that during the questioning, Officer Davis ordered Mr. Harrell to remove his hands from his pockets. And the testimony in Davis's words were, and I'm quoting from page 10 of the suppression hearing transcript, "I told him to take his hands out of his pockets, which he did do." This wasn't a request to take his hands out of his pockets. This was an order. Now, importantly, each of these three facts involved, I think, demands, really, by the officers. They weren't requests. And it's our contention that Mr. Harrell was seized at the very latest by the time Officer Davis ordered him to take his hands.
An officer, for officer protection purposes and safety purposes, say to a person with whom he may be having a consensual encounter, take your hands out of your pockets?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think, and this is something the Attorney General relies on, the decision in People v. Sheffer, which is cited in the Attorney General's brief, in which I discussed at some length in my reply brief. Sheffer had a statement in there that said, and I'm quoting, an officer may provide instructions to a person necessarily required for a safe encounter without converting the encounter into an investigatory stop. And I think absent any qualification, that's not quite right, because I think it confuses really two distinct concepts, which are the appropriateness of an officer's demand versus the legal and practical effect of that demand. And it kind of flips the two on the head. Under Terry, the question is first, whether someone was stopped, and second, whether the stop was justified. And I think that statement, frankly, gets them a little reversed. I think Sheffer involved facts, though, that are much different than the facts presented here. In Sheffer, the division held that a defendant was not seized when, among other things, the officer asked the defendant if he could speak with him, asked the defendant to set down his bag, asked the defendant if he had recently purchased iodine at the store, asked the defendant for consent to search his bag, asked the defendant if he had any weapons, and then asked for permission to pat him down for weapons. Those were all requests by the officers, and indeed, the decision in Sheffer goes to great lengths to say, I think there's a full paragraph in the opinion that is devoted to saying the defendant was not seized when the officer asked him to put the bag down, because the officer asked. It was a request. It was seeking the voluntary cooperation of the suspect. Here, we don't have those requests. We have demands. And so I think Sheffer is distinguishable on those grounds. I think there's another point I would make about Sheffer and the statement which we just discussed, which that an officer could take any action necessary for officer safety without necessarily converting it into an investigatory stop. I certainly don't mean to diminish the true feeling, the true nature of these encounters, and that officers have justifiable concerns for their safety, but that doesn't necessarily mean that the officer can force the defendant to do anything the officer thinks is reasonable, or force the defendant to do any action for officer safety. And I'll give kind of an extreme hypothetical, which I think demonstrates the point. If an officer is responding to a bank robbery, an armed robbery, and sees the suspect leaving the bank, and the suspect has a gun, the officer is fully justified in pulling out his weapon and telling the suspect to freeze. And if the suspect freezes and puts down the gun, that's absolutely a seizure. I don't think anyone would argue otherwise, even if it was justified as a matter of officer safety. So there are two distinct questions. I see that I only have about 2 minutes left, so I'd like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal unless the court has other questions.
May it please the court. My name is Jillian Price, bar number 40815, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. Initially, the people don't object per se to the defendant's request to hold this case pending the resolution of Newhouse and Hoffman. However, it is our position that there's no need for the court to do that. First, in respect to Judge Hawthorne's question in People v. McMurtry, the Colorado Supreme Court explicitly said, it said that while conditional guilty pleas have never explicitly been approved in the state of Colorado, they would leave for another day the discussion of the resolution of that issue. But based on McMurtry and based on Newhouse, it is the people's position that absent a rule or statute of which Colorado currently has none, conditional guilty pleas are not valid, and just as in Newhouse, this case should be dismissed. Now, that being said, there's another reason why this court need not hold the resolution of this case, and that is because the trial court properly determined that this was a consensual encounter and therefore properly denied the motion to suppress.
There you go there. Let me ask you this. Are you agreeing or conceding that the defendant entered a conditional guilty plea in this case?
I would characterize it as a conditional guilty plea, and here's why. Below the prosecutor, as your honors have pointed out, the prosecutor specifically explained to Mr. Harrell that there is a split in the law, and that his reasonable belief was that that split would be resolved in favor of the people's position. Again, the conditional guilty pleas are not valid. In that case, Mr. Harrell was fully advised that this was a condition upon a condition, and he was, again, fully advised that he may not have the right to appeal. Just as the court determined in Newhouse, where this kind of conditional plea is entered, a defendant waives any appellate rights, especially here where there's no jurisdictional issues. So in that case, I wouldn't say that we concede that there's a conditional guilty plea.
For example, in McMurray, the court concluded that's not a conditional guilty. So, I mean, sounds like it's very similar to the facts in this case.
Yes, I agree. And indeed, under McMurtry, which again notes that conditional guilty pleas have never been endorsed in this state for suppression issues, just as here, this court may but need not hold the resolution, pending the resolution of Newhouse and Hoffman.
We don't usually render an opinion on a ground not asserted by one of the parties. And so I guess the question to you is, are you conceding for purposes of getting the case before us that there was a conditional guilty plea? Without regard to how we rule either on whether it's valid or your alternative ground that there was a consensual interview.
No, we do not so concede, just for the purposes of having the case in front of you. Indeed, our position is that this case should not be in front of you because conditional guilty pleas are not valid.
You're saying two I hear you saying it shouldn't be before us because conditional guilty pleas are not valid. I want to make sure that you understand what my question was. My question was, do the facts in this case show, and do you stipulate that they show, this was a conditional guilty plea? Because if it's not a conditional guilty plea, it seems to me the McMurtry case pretty squarely says, if it's not a conditional guilty plea, we don't even get to the analysis. So am I being clear enough, or do we need to talk about it some more?
No, Your Honor, that is clear. And I do not believe that the people below or here have ever conceded or stipulated that this was a conditional guilty plea. Now, to the extent that this court determines to the contrary, to the extent that this court determines that there was a conditional guilty plea that allows Mr. Harrell to bring its claims before you, this court
Counsel, it sounds like we're still not settled on this, because you said that allows Mr. Harrell to bring the claims before you. Judge Casebolt's question was, is there a conditional guilty plea, irrespective of whether we believe such pleas are allowed? Okay, was it made conditional as a factual matter in the trial court? Okay, because if we decide no, then the decision is simply, it's not a conditional plea, the case is dismissed, you pled guilty, we don't get to the merits, we don't get to anything. If we decide there was a conditional guilty plea as a factual matter, then we have to answer the question, are conditional pleas valid? Okay, that's where we're going with this, and it sounds like you still haven't understood where we're going with this. Do the people concede, as a factual matter, there was a conditional plea, at least attempted in the trial court, a conditional plea, whether they're valid or not, that's a legal question, but that the plea was conditional?
As Your Honor has phrased it, yes, a conditional guilty plea was attempted at the trial court level.
So, in other words, you're not saying that the defendant is out of court because there was no conditional plea. He pled guilty, and having pled guilty, waived rights to challenge all decisions of the trial court. You're not saying that.
No, we're saying, again, as Your Honor just pointed out, he did attempt a conditional guilty plea, which the trial court allowed.
Trial court allowed, okay.
All right. The second issue that this court would need to consider, again, regardless of the conditional plea issue, is whether or not this was indeed a consensual encounter. the facts, which are undisputed in this case and by which this court is bound, indicate that this was, in fact, a consensual encounter. Now, my colleague has pointed out three specific areas which he believes show the contrary, that a seizure has occurred, and it is the people's position that he has not carried his burden to establish by a preponderance that this was, in fact, a seizure. First, Mr. Mueller makes a big deal about the fact that the officer used the word stop during the suppression hearing. Now, when read in context, the record shows that the word stop was used in common parlance in the same way that we might stop a colleague in the hallway to say hello. The officer was not using the word stop to indicate that he seized, under the Fourth Amendment, Mr. Harrell. There's no evidence in the record that the officer displayed any such control that would elevate this consensual encounter into a stop. Secondly, Mr. Mueller makes a big emphasis on the fact that Mr. Harrell and his friend were spoken to separately. Now, there's no evidence in the record that the officers physically separated Mr. Harrell from Mr. Purdy. The record does show that Officer Davis spoke with Mr. Harrell and his two fellow officers spoke with Mr. Purdy. But there is no evidence in the record about how this separation occurred. It's simply the fact that they were spoken with in separate areas. Now, at the suppression hearing, Mr. Harrell also testifies that he was waiting for his friend in front of this apartment building. But again, the record doesn't show that the officers separated these two men. Furthermore, there's no evidence in the record that any of the officers, especially Mr. Davis, impeded Mr. Harrell's path, prevented him from leaving, or in any way restrained him from leaving that situation. Thirdly, Mr. Mueller cites that the officer asked Mr. Harrell to remove his hands from his pockets. Now, under People v. Sheffer, the law is clear that an officer may provide instructions to a person necessarily required for a safe encounter without converting that encounter to an investigatory stop. Here, the officer noticed that Mr. Harrell had his hands in his pockets, and he noticed some bulges in those pockets. As a matter of officer safety, the officer was justified in asking Mr. Harrell to remove his hands. And again, in Schaefer, an officer doing exactly that, instructing him to remove his hands from his pockets, does not constitute a show of authority for the purposes of a consensual interview. Under these circumstances, again, the undisputed facts, which the trial court found and which this court respectfully is bound by, show that this was a consensual encounter. Therefore, the trial court properly denied Mr. Harrell's motion to suppress, and this court should affirm that ruling.
Does it matter whether the officer demands or asks the person that he has a conversation with, will you please?
Well, I think that's a determination that has to be made in conjunction with the totality of the circumstances. And under some circumstances, which are not present here, a demand may be enough to convert a consensual encounter into a stop. However, here, the officer, I disagree with Mr. Mueller's characterization that the officer demanded that Mr. Harrell take his hands out of his pockets. The transcript reads, I told Mr. Harrell to take his hands out of his pockets, which he did do, but there is no indication of the specific language that the officer used or whether the officer phrased it in terms of a question or not. But looking at the remaining circumstances, the totality of the circumstances here, the officer maintained a conversational tone. His questions were otherwise benign. There was no indication in the record that at that request, the officer was doing anything but ensuring his safety. Under these circumstances, this was a consensual interview. And unless this court has any further questions for me, the people would request that this court affirm the trial court's ruling.
I guess I have another question. I have to ask this. I get the feeling that you quite understand your concession that Judge Jones asked you about. Are you conceding that a defendant can decide on his own or her own that they can enter a conditional guilty plea, and that when the prosecutor says, I object, I disagree, that this is a conditional guilty plea, and the judge says, Well, you can go ahead and try if you want. The court may take it. You're conceding that that is a conditional guilty plea. And that it's properly before us.
As I understood Judge Jones's question, and I apologize if I misunderstood, he asked if I conceded that the defendant attempted a conditional guilty plea below. I did respond to Judge Jones that yes, the defendant attempted a guilty plea. Now, what I understand you to be asking is...
Judge Jones also asked you if you agreed that the court approved it. And you said yes, you conceded that the court approved it.
Well, and to the extent that Mr. Harrell was advised by both the people and the trial court that there is a split in the law and that Mr. Harrell did face the reality that this court might not hear his appeal because, again, there is a split in the law as to the validity of guilty pleas. Under those circumstances, the trial court still allowed that plea to enter. So the people are not necessarily conceding that below the prosecutor said, sure, yeah, this is a conditional guilty plea. That's not what occurred. The trial court essentially, as Your Honor just pointed out, told Mr. Harrell, okay, there's a split in the law. You have the realistic possibility that the trial court, that the appellate court will not hear your claims, but you can go ahead and give it a try. That, I think, could be construed as a conditional guilty plea, but we're not conceding that that's what the people agreed to below. Thank you.
I think I'll start quickly with the conditional guilty plea issue. My understanding is that this was a conditional guilty plea, and I think the trial court accepted it as such. The trial court said, and this is on page 5 of the plea hearing, okay, and here's the deal. Obviously, the lawyers disagree on whether you can appeal. You're not forfeiting your right to request an appeal. Now, if there wasn't an agreement between the parties that this was a conditional plea, then that statement was wrong. Because if there wasn't a conditional plea, then my client was forfeiting his right to appeal. So the trial court accepted a conditional plea, and the Attorney General didn't argue otherwise in their answer brief, and so I would submit that this was a conditional guilty plea, and the Supreme Court will ultimately decide whether that's valid or not, and I would ask the court to hold the case, if you agree with me that this was a conditional plea, until the Supreme Court rules in Hoffman and Newhouse. Just a couple other points. On whether or not Mr. Harrell and Mr. Purdy were separated, I think it's clear they were, and this is from page 23 of the suppression hearing transcript. The trial court says, when Officer Davis questioned Mr. Harrell, he was alone. And I think the only thing that can be read from that is that there was some separation. As I said in my opening, I don't know how far, what the distance was between the two parties, but there was a physical separation between Mr. Harrell and Mr. Purdy. And so for all the reasons in the briefs and the reasons I've given today, I would ask this court to hold the case pending the Supreme Court's decision in Newhouse and Hoffman, and if that court affirms the validity of conditional guilty pleas, to reverse the trial court's ruling denying my client's motion to suppress. Thank you.
Counsel, the case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.